So my next speaker is Willem van der Post, who is also a chartered accountant by training. He was actually a managing partner at Deloitte Africa at one stage, where he managed their center for innovation business, I think it was. So basically it was a disruptive and innovation business within Deloitte, but he also then went on to found his own business, of which he is CEO, really around also this idea of disruption. He also serves as strategic advisor to a number of fintech businesses internationally, and he's really here to disrupt us and make us think a little bit more differently, hopefully a lot more differently on how we do our day-to-day business. Willem, please join me on stage.
Let's just see if I'm on. There we go. A kind introduction. Appreciate that. It's a pity I didn't know you earlier in my life so that you could introduce me to my mother-in-law. Thanks for having me. As you heard, I'm a CA, so I'm a little bit outnumbered on the IQ front. It's quite intimidating to be in a room full of the likes of all of you, but I'm going to give it a shot. As you heard, ex-professional services, and then I suppose all of us go through experiences in our life subsequent to which things can never be the same again. And I had two of those. The first is a much longer story. It revolves around low orbit around Earth with a whole bunch of venture capitalists that tried to pioneer reusable rockets. And you ended up sort of in a gravity-lessness around the planet. And weird things happen to you when you do that. I'll give you just a quick example. What is the time, sir? Just watch what he does. He looks at his watch. All right, why do you look at your watch? Because it's programmed, right, for where you are on the planet. So you take the map of the Earth, you cut it open, 24 sections, depending on which section you are. That's the time zone, and the time zone tells you what time it is. If you're not on the planet, what time is it? So like a couple of weird things happen to some of the fundamentals of how you think, and I landed, and Deloitte sent the email around, can all partners please submit their timesheets? And I just thought, I don't know how I'm going to answer this. And it also sort of woke up, I suppose, a desire of mine to be involved in building stuff as opposed to peddling PowerPoints and then ultimately selling company SAP, which is really the business model. And so as a part of that endeavor, I withdrew my capital, started a venture capital fund, which is called XTech Capital. Very boutique, small, nothing to the numbers that you guys are talking about, both on the quantum, but also on the returns. We don't do 8, 12, 15% stuff. We go zero if we get it wrong, or we go 400 if we get it right. So professional gambler, some might say. And in that space, in looking at these early startups, I developed a view that education needs fundamental reform on this planet. If you think about it just ideologically, there are a whole bunch of people that when they reach adulthood, it seems to be a lot easier to sit on the couch and bitch about issues than it is to actually get involved in solving them. Somewhere we lose our naivety and our enthusiasm for getting involved. Where's my paycheck? And I think it has something to do with KPIs being centered around things that the current business model needs that drives that 8 to 10 to maybe 12% growth. So most people have, as you know, a white picket fence, 2.4 kids, and a Volvo, and that needs to be paid for, and it's paid for by virtue of meeting your KPIs, not by virtue of disrupting or getting involved in larger societal issues. So I started a school, and I was a headmaster for a little while. It was a total hack job. It's not professional at all. We ran it all over the world, Dubai, New York, some in Los Angeles, and then one in Prague, where a young kid from down under showed up and heard about 3D printing, robotics, AI, and IoT, and he combined all of those in a little project when he went back home in his little coastal town, and he built a 3D printed orca loaded with sensors, and this thing would swim around the coastline and collect data, which he would then use, his idea at least, to do environmental management, so environment management or disaster preparedness. And inadvertently, this kid scared off all the sharks because orcas and sharks don't cohabit. The sharks buggered off. It became safe to swim, which meant that families came with their kids, so they stayed longer. So the bed and breakfast industry boomed, the restaurant industry boomed, the pub industry boomed, and the local municipality realized that they didn't know enough or didn't have enough data to deal with like their responsibility of dealing with environmental management and disaster preparedness. So they cut a deal with this 14-year-old kid who then earned a percentage of the sales tax that they collect off all of these industries that have risen, and they made this win-win deal, and there was this 14-year-old kid that earned more than $1 million a year. Yeah, exactly, no? So the power of re-looking how we look at some of our environmental issues and the capabilities associated with, specifically out of my passion, technology-enabled businesses, led me to run the school. And in that school, it turned out that the parents needed it more than the kids did, because the kids are naive. They don't have medical aids to pay for or bonds to cover. And so they still think freely with creativity, whereas parents seem to be focused around those KPIs that I'd mentioned. In that, I ended up in front of a whole bunch of corporates. I think that's how I got the gig today. And end up talking to people that are midway through or halfway through career, or the very dangerous ones that are near the end of their career, because they hang on with white-knuckle death grip to avoid change, specifically if they get confronted with some of the content I'm going to show you today. And I think it's by virtue of the education system, again, that forces retrospective analysis rather than prospective exploration. Even the zenith of academic excellence in the world, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, all rely on case studies. So this is a scenario that has already occurred. Here's what worked, here's what didn't work. Plug thousands of those at a high cost into your head and hope that when you confront something similar in life, you can remember which things worked and which things didn't. So it's not really, it's looking for efficiencies. It's not really coming up with new solutions. So I found that there are typically five, and I'm hoping to inspire a sixth, but like perspectives in the room, you might resonate with this, or you might feel affronted, sorry, if you do. the first is that you feel like a hostage sitting here today, because you have to be here because of something like CPD, or your boss is in one of the rooms here, and there's a register that you had to sign, you paid for it, so you must be here. Something like that, you don't really want to be here, you don't really want to be confronted with change, you want to get back to your 8% growth, and be calm, and not have to worry about all this other crap that's going on in the world. And so you feel like a hostage. And what that does to how you consume the content today has an impact on it, right? There's a plus and a minus to it, but I often see this. The next one is that someone thinks, hey, man, day out of the office. This is more relaxing. So I get to chill. I get to see some colleagues. There will be a gin and tonic afterwards. I'm going to drink some of that. And my emails and my WhatsApp can park for a day. So the vacationer also comes with a perspective that has a very profound impact on how they absorb this content today or what they do with it in the future. This one I love. This is the PhD. This is a person who waits for the Q&A section, but like in great anticipation, because they've also read a little bit about AI or IoT or kids printing AUKUS. And actually, they don't have a question. They just want to show that they also know this shit. So they are sitting in anticipation, waiting for that moment of glory. And it's always fun to have them in the room. Often in corporate, I get the cheerleader. This is a person who is ultra enthusiastic, high energy, high velocity, like a vector. Clueless on strategy, but very gung-ho, let's go team. Equal fundamental impacts on what you do with the content, and also actually practically what happens to the organizations where we do these venture capital deals with. And then tell me what you think this is. If you have seen this part of my talk before, don't give the surprise away, but what do you think? Just I'll make this a bit more interactive. A little lecture here today. I stopped being a headmaster. What do you think it is? I beg your pardon? A fractal. I have actually never heard that or know what you mean. But no, it's not a fractal. I told you I'm outnumbered when I started. I often, in the time of COVID, got, this must be like a virus, right? Looks like a fallopian tube. I have had that before. That was at the Sexpo. But ladies and gents, if you had your thoughts centered around something DNA or body-like, then you're in the right ballpark. If you think it is a virus, you're so wrong that you are almost right again, because this is the opposite of a virus, antibody. And the job of this thing in the human body is to scour around the environment within which it finds itself, look for change, and then kill it, softly, quietly, but quickly. And in a corporate, there are a lot of personas that adopt the antibody stance. Typically, you find they're closer to retirement, so that it can be the next guy's problem to deal with automation or digital transformation or whatever the consultants peddle nowadays as verbiage. And if I see that what you are proposing will touch my P&L, the number of people that report to me, or have any possible negative impact on my bonus, then I will sit in the meeting and say, yeah, that's a very good idea, great idea, great idea. And when it happens practically, I kill it. And those are very dangerous. But the problem, of course, is that those are malicious and obvious. Once you learn how to spot them, by my estimation, 25% of every room is full of antibodies. or at different stages of the conversation inadvertently becomes an antibody. And that's because of the perception of danger associated with some of this content. Because we are hardwired to look for this sort of thing as a human. If you think about our operating software, our MS-DOS, if you like, there are four things that it needs to manage. Where's the food? Where's the shelter? Where's the danger? And where's there someone to mate with? If you're from Wurzgel Rudeburg, like I am, that was not the order in which you thought about those things, but those were the four things that you definitely needed to look at. And in the danger space, your anticipation or perception of the size of the threat of the change around you or the thing that will cause you discomfort dictates the size of your reaction toward it. So typically a negative reaction or a killing reaction. And so quite often we find that in this space, that happens because it is so fundamentally raw. A place where it has happened in the past, I've just unplugged myself. Let me do it back. There we go. It's been the transportation industry. So I'll just take a second to come back, I'm sure. And I'll show you two pictures here on the left and on the right. It's the same street in Manhattan. It's Fifth Avenue, and it's more or less the same time of the year, so it's Easter parades. On the left-hand side, I've helped you spot the first car in and amongst all of the horses. And on the right-hand side, the last horse in and amongst all of the cars. And the picture is 13 years apart. So in 13 years, you have a lot of time to adjust to change and get used to the idea. But can I just ask you, like, why were some saddle makers out of business soon after this or during this period? Imagine that we were saddle makers. So in other words, a critical part of the transportation industry as it stood, incumbents really, and we saw this car drive past. What is our reaction? I do a poll normally. We don't have time today because I've got a short slot with you. But it's novel, expensive, dangerous, makes a lot of noise. You can imagine those types of, if you're used to horse hoofs clicking on the road, manure everywhere, dusty roads, and suddenly this contraption that's a combustion engine drives past you, the first one you've ever seen. What is your reaction to that? And then, of course, 13 years later, if you're still trying to make saddles, you've got a problem because now to drive a horse down a road, you need a permit. If you want to keep more than one horse on your property, you need to rezone your property because of the health and safety ordinances. So the fundamental reform that's taken place. But what were the clues that were in there? Because the car is not actually a technology or the automobile. It's combustion engine, formalization of the petroleum industry, assembly line. So there were a whole bunch of these at different times, technological advances that took place. But it's a hard thing to string together and go, this is what the outcomes are going to be. So technology in itself, I find, is an extremely fast-moving thing. And by itself, you can kind of wrap your head around it. But when they start to converge, it causes the chaos, which is where us as humans are geared for retrospective analysis as opposed to prospective exploration. All right, so what were the reactions of the saddle makers? Because what it had meant was, if I am in product innovation, trying to keep my business alive or grow it, and I'm a saddle maker, I'm looking for saddles that can support extra payload, so maybe cargo or extra passenger, or a lighter weight saddle so that I could race, or a two-passenger one, or a leather one, or a synthetic one. But I'm still in the mind space of product innovation around my incumbent state. Whereas if I went into dashboards, keyrings, car seats, it meant that I needed different talent because my client has shifted, which means that my market structures has shifted by virtue of the goods and services that I offer that are necessitated to change. And that is a lot of change for a CEO or a business leader to bite off and say, I'm going to go away from what gives me a steady 8 to 9 to 10% every year and I can bank on it. And this could go south. And I find that that courage is ill-represented in the market. Let me just say that much. What this also then ultimately leads to as an early show of where this type of industry disruption goes is mass customization. Here's a brand that we all know. It's Starbucks, it's a coffee purveyor. There are 88,000 different combinations in which you can buy the same product, but there are only four roasts on their menu. And it comes from all of these product customizations in trying to please and serve your customer, as opposed to saying, stuff you, this is the way that it's done and has been done for 100 years, and we're going to white-knuckle death grip hang on to that. And you can imagine this. When you walk through this process of creating a coffee with Starbucks, it starts with, what is the size? Now, there are multiple sizes that you can choose from. And then, what about the milk? Half and half, skinny, full cream, organic, genetically modified, not genetically modified, added vitamins, if you want to, which ones do you want? Then all the tirlantenkis that you can add to it. What about a bit of vanilla spice or pumpkin spice in the festive season? And so you carry on, get to the end of this process. You pay $3.50 at 17 rand a dollar for your cup of coffee. You take a sip and it's terrible. Who do you blame? Can't blame them. They did what you said. So it's you, right? So it's your problem. So what do? You recycle. You come back. Next time you take the vanilla instead of the pumpkin spice and you take maybe full cream milk. You try it again, another $3.50. And you do this and you do this and you do this until you get to your Goldilocks moment. And you have the perfect coffee. And what do then? And you buy it all the time because it's now perfect, right? So you've created this perfect product at your own cost. So like the R&D that sits behind this sort of adoption of this open perspective around how to treat your market and your client has got upside in it if you get it right. And now there are technology tools that allow us to do this, even to the extent of bonding you emotionally to your end product by writing your name on it and typically calling out Willem, which is the wrong way to pronounce it, but still tries to bond me to it. And if you look at this standing, dynamic, and you stand back a little bit, what you find is what we call the big shift. In fact, John Hagel calls it the big shift. It's this bifurcation of the market. Fragmentation down to the individual, where talented people in large organizations grow frustrated with bureaucracy, red tape, and bullshit, and they end up leaving with a high degree of capability into a networked concentration worldwide that has now, through COVID, been catapulted into state of status quo and nothing in between. And this network concentration we see in the exponential organization space, that first mover takes 60% of the market, first successful mover takes 60% of the market, second mover takes 30%, and everyone else fights for the last 10%, which is why there's the word disruption and why consultants make money off of it, because that's when some of these organizations just don't have enough market space to stay alive with. All right, so I mentioned exponential technologies. I actually called out a few of them already. I just ask you this. Let me go dark here for a second. There are 16 of them. They have, like the horse and cart scenario, profound potential impact on our businesses and our business models. If we don't know what they are, how will we prepare for them? And if we don't know what they are, how could we be at the top of a P&L directing a whole bunch of people and youngsters in their careers as to their jobs? So can I ask you, take 15, 20 seconds and somewhere in shorthand on the paper that you've been given, see if you can write down 16 of the 16 exponential technologies. Just take a second. You've already heard me say AI, so there's the first one for free. So now I need 15. Just give it a shot. And I want you to go through the neuroscientific process of trying to write down what you think they are, because they're going to impact our industries. And I will give you also, I'm not trying to catch you out or anything. When I did the first time, I scored 3. the average Fortune 500 C-suite gets 5.4. So,
what's an exponential technology?
I'm going, okay, so it's technologies that play within the realm of what I'm talking about. They'll come by different names, and I am actually going to touch on the definition thereof. But just take 30 seconds, and then give me an idea, just by show of hands, how many you think you got. I won't ask you to name yours. Self-driving car is not one. Moeilijk. I know. We've done this for half of the JSE Top 40 and some others on the exchange. South Africa's average is more or less the same as the world average, like 5.5, 6 that the guys get. There was one CFO in Pepkor who got 9. He holds the record. Let's see if anyone else beats that record today. Does it feel lonely trying to write down 16? Let's do this. Show of hands. Who got? Let's put the crib sheet up, because this, what you essentially are looking at, is what should be, I think, the adult and child. It should be built into curriculums of education, right? So top left. Nanotech or advanced material science. Any takers? Someone at Finnish show of hands. Oh, got some. Okay, moi. Quantum computing next to that. Touch your industry for sure. Ooh, 3. That's okay. There you go. AI, which everyone, I'm sure. Yeah? You're leaving me on top stick. Like you don't want to participate. Fine, I'll go faster. Machine learning next to that, which is actually different from AI. Extended reality, not virtual reality. Robotics. Yeah, moi. Digital biology. Moi. Okay, but you've heard it, so you're cheating. All right. Space technology is one of my favorite ones. Drones, alternative energy, blockchain, about which you have a talk in the agenda. Cryptography, which kind of relies on that. Internet of things, so billions of sensors connected, providing data. Additive manufacturing or 3D printing. Yeah, moi. Okay, that's a part. And crowd, both crowdsourcing as well as crowdfunding, because if you count it, there are 15, but crowd goes into 2. And of course, as I had said, when they converge is where the magic lies or the disruption lies. So I've asked you to list them. I won't ask who got what But what I did want to just quickly touch on, given the question is, what are exponential technologies? Typically, the ones that double in capability, double in capacity, or halve in price, or a combination of those three factors on every cycle. The cycle used to be about 18 months, if you look at Moore's Law. Today, it's closer to 11 months. So it's going faster and more profound. I don't need to do this math of compound interest in this room, I'm sure, but just tangibly, I think why exponentials are so out of the frame of mind of the average business leader is because it becomes stupid. If you pace a snail, literally we measured this, they move in a garden. We put salt and leaves and we tested it. 0.047 kilometers an hour. I mean, watching paint dry is literally double the excitement, right? And then on every iteration, if you let the snail double, theoretically, you get to a point where after 9 iterations, this thing is overtaking Usain Bolt on a 100-meter race. Now, just imagine that visually for a second. All right, if you do it 19 times, you're overtaking a space rocket from SpaceX as it breaks the gravitational pull of the Earth. And then when you get to sort of 30, bearing in mind that something like 3D printing is 44 years old this year, so now you're in those iterations that are starting to make like weird things happen to your mind. You're in the space where you've got to change the denomination for it to make sense. It's like saying all of us know what 200 kilometers an hour look like because some asshole in an X5 has overtaken you on the freeway flashing. So you have an idea of what that looks like. You've been in an airplane that does 1,000 kilometers an hour, but what is 1,000,000 kilometers an hour? And can we conceptually wrap our heads around that from a relational perspective? And I think that's why this falls off business leaders' radar. If I said to you, take one step and double it every single time after, I think it's 27 iterations, you've gone, after 30 iterations, you've gone around the planet Earth 27 times. And that causes this difference in landscape, which very few people seem to appreciate in their strategic planning, which is why we still have organizations that do 5-year strategic plans. I mean, for crying out loud, if the environment is moving that fast, how relevant is your plan in 18 months? So there's a lot of adjustment that needs doing. Jeremy Gardner does this thing about R1 trillion has been stolen through state capture. And he says, well, how much is a trillion? Can you, like, if you just think about it, if it's 100 rand notes, would it fill this room? Like, I have no idea. I've never seen R1 trillion before. But, like, how much is R1 trillion? So he equates it to time. And he says, if a rand is a second, look at these numbers. A million would be 11 days. A billion would be 31 years. And R1 trillion would be, on average, like 400 generations. So it escapes us. And again, this point of our operating software that hasn't had a software upgrade for the last 50,000 years. Our MS-DOS is still coded to look after those four things that I had mentioned earlier. And then there's the human interaction with this type of content, which is the Gartner hype cycle, which I'm sure you've also seen. Somewhere a technology is triggered. It looks novel. The hackers tell their mate to tell their mate to tell their mate to tell their mates. It becomes mainstream. Take something like a cryptocurrency, exchanges start to pop up all over the world. Peak of inflated expectations. You'll read about how we're going to get our salaries, pay off our cars, earn our retirement funding in cryptography. Okay, then it doesn't happen. So the price starts to crash and more people pull out of it. You get into the trough of disillusion. This is where my dad says, I told you this would happen. Right? He's the guy that to this day wants to go to the branch in the bank because he doesn't trust the app. And my app works every single time. I've never been in a branch for the last 20 years of my life. But that one time that I sit without connection, he'll say, I told you so. All right, so he, in that moment, is an antibody, if you think about it. In the background, the hackers don't give up because my dad is celebrating and I'm disillusioned. They carry on, and the actual technology capability matures. It becomes a business case as opposed to just a use case, and adoption starts to ensue. And you have a car that drives past as we are mounting our horses. And just out of interest, quite interesting if you map something like Bitcoin price. I'm not a big Bitcoin proponent, by the way, but just if you map the price relative to the sentimental analysis, it totally mirrors. And this has happened again, by the way, in the latest crash, as more and more people start to adopt. Here's a question for you. In this evolution, what the hell do we do with our organizations, our jobs, our personal lives even? Consider this. Here's the music industry and the major technological advances that have taken place in the evolution of this industry as technology started to impact it. First available gramophone player commercially, 1877, 60 years to get to LPs, 30 years to get to tapes, 20 years to get to CDs. And then here in the knee of the curve, the MP3 moment. So here, both the medium and the media have been digitized. They become intangible. Can't touch an MP3, right? could touch a CD. But then check what the industry does. And this holds true for almost every industry that you can think of. They make a better CD. Okay, but we've just gotten rid of the capability or the necessity, rather, to have CDs in the first place. We can now digitally distribute to the entire world, cross-border, no problemo, no cost, no incremental cost. And R&D goes into producing more of what we had used to do in the past. Why? Because we're retrospective and analysis as opposed to prospective and explorative. And then the incumbents, that big shift that I spoke about, first successful mover, takes 60% of the market. So new services, devices that support those services, ancillary services, other industries, and finally ubiquity. First successful mover, huge upside. That's why in VC, if you get this right, you're talking 400% returns. And the club of companies that is populating that space that have grown to these sort of billion-dollar valuations out of seemingly nowhere. By the way, if you trace back a lot of the founders of these companies, they come from the great financial crisis in the banking industry. So talented people, educated, although I know the irony of what I just said, and at the same time, still full of energy to do something with their lives, too early to retire, and they start solutions. These solutions being technologically enabled are displacing large companies. And if you look at your classification as an S&P 500 and how long you would stay in that class, it's starting to decrease. By the 2020 numbers, it looks like it'll be around 11 years as more and more of these high pop companies are making their way onto public markets, where the seeking of growth is starting to outweigh the seeking of NAV. All right. Now, earlier, Caitlin mentioned ESG and the tick box exercise. I just made a note of that because I wanted to talk about this. We, in our fund, look for exponential organizations, the ones that do that hockey stick curve, as everyone does, because I've met so many trillionaires that are trillionaires in Excel, all right? But then in the bank balance is a different story, okay? But there are these companies that if you pick them in the right fashion and you pick the entrepreneur based on who the person is, and you can match those two, then there are some magic things that can happen. I'm not an Elon groupie, but he serves a good purpose for my illustration here. One of the things that we look for is purpose. I'm an investment guy. I'm 100% capitalist, but purpose, right? So if you look at a company like Tesla and you look at that date on your cell phone, that was a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the automotive industry, the number of cars that you've sold is critically important. That's what analysts base your share price on. And so the expectations versus the actual is the moment of truth. And that then the fourth quarter moment of truth. So on the Monday, Tesla realized we've sold enough cars. The cars have been sold. The money's in the bank, or the Bitcoin that they sold some of these cars for in the bank or in the vault. And now we must just get the car to the person. But the thing about a Tesla, I don't know if you've driven a Tesla, it is not a key that you walk up to your car, click, and it's in your keyless in your pocket. It's werk op jou aan 'n manier, right? So this thing has got cameras. It's this facial recognition. And when you get into the car, it's not just start and drive. It's how would you like to drive? Am I driving? Are we driving? Or are you driving? Because it does have self-drive capability. And depending on the legislative environment or jurisdiction that you find yourself in, some of those might be appropriate and some of those might be inappropriate. So it's not just give me your license, your proof of residence, here's your car, bugger off. There's a whole orientation process to get a driver acclimatized to drive his or her Tesla. And that takes time. And on the Monday, when they thought they'd made enough sales, and you would have seen some of the tweets and the SEC's reaction to the share price impact that it had in that time, they realized, oh shit, we're not going to move enough of these cars fast enough because of that onboarding time. So they tweeted about that. And on the Friday, people from different states in North America showed up at Tesla dealerships and offered on a volunteer basis their time to help new users on board to use Teslas. Now, just for a second, ask yourself, I mean, I've got stronger language than this, but how the hell did that happen? And why? And like, what drew previous consumers of this product suite to come to the provider of the product suite and help them distribute more? Can you foresee in your organization some of your existing customers showing up and saying, listen, I know the KYC is an issue when they're trying to onboard new investors. Can I help you over the weekend do the KYC so that you can get more investors? I mean, it's ludicrous, right? But yet, yeah, the equivalent of that had happened. And the reason we believe strongly is because of the purpose of what Tesla's trying to achieve. Because not really a car company. Some say it's a tech company with wheels. But actually, it's an energy reform company. They're stated what we call MTP, massively transformative purpose, is to fast forward the world's use of alternative energy sources. And we happen to do it through energy-consuming or high-consuming methodology like a vehicle. And that purpose is what causes people to center around it. In 2018, 220 of the biggest CEOs in the world, of which this guy was there, the Apple guy was there, signed a petition to the federal government in the U.S. to relook their equivalent of the Companies Act to differentiate between organizations that are purpose-driven and those that are profit-only driven. So we're not saying purpose does not have profit in it. That's very profitable, all right? Or cash generative, rather. Differentiate between them, because the thinking is that in a short space of time, you won't be able to put public money behind companies that are only profit-driven. It has to serve society at a larger scale. There needs to be a tie-down between the business model and what it tries to achieve. All right, I am going to just quickly do one more thing for you. So there's 16 of these technologies. I just wanted to take a little closer look at AI quickly, because I don't think you can walk into any financial services organization nowadays and spend 30 minutes without hearing the word AI at least twice from someone who claims it. If it's a consultant, you'll hear it four times. If it's an employee, maybe two or three times. But I wanted to delve a little bit deeper into it. So can I just ask you to do this? The next time someone says to you, blah, 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 AI, ask them which AI, which type. Because there's like 36 different subsets of AI. And I think the colloquialism that the consulting world has left us with often leads to bad application or use case versus business case. So push them around a little bit by getting a bit deeper involved into what AI really has as an underlying building block. Because the ecosystem that sits around this is huge. The number of startups and the number of capital flowing into this space is immense. And you can see it there by brand names. And if you plot this evolutionary curve, this exponential curve, logarithmic really, and you look at some of the early genesis of where AI was used. Here's a FMCG shop in the US, and they do direct marketing. So if you've got this smart shopper card equivalent, like we've got the blue one from Pick and Pay or Builder's Warehouse or whatever, they had one, the redder, the better. They would record your data and they would see what you bought. And then over time, have enough of data to anticipate. So it went from insights, retrospective to prescriptive almost. And there's a story of a father in Omaha who barges into a Target shop and says, where's the store manager? Where's he? Walks up to the store manager, grabs him by the lapels, pulls off two buttons of his shirt. Altercation ensues. They pull each other apart. What's going on here? And the father says, you send my daughter this. And he takes out a pamphlet. And the store manager says, so we send out hundreds of millions of pamphlets with specials in them. It's how we get you to come to the store, tear out the coupon, get a discount, you buy some other stuff. He says, yeah, but you send this to my daughter. So we send it to everyone. Your daughter must have a card. He says, yeah, Makeki, so are you advocating premarital sex to her? Store manager says, what the hell do you mean? Makeup, formula, car seat, diapers. He says, she's 16, man. What the hell are you doing? And the guy says, group function, sir. Group marketing looked at this, or head office. I'll come back to you. Give me a week or so just to come back. A week later, the dad's back. Store manager sees him. Doesn't want to engage him because he's still got this conflict. Father finds him in the diaper aisle. And he says, hey, listen, I'm here to apologize because some things were happening in my house that I might not necessarily have been aware of. My daughter is, in fact, pregnant. And, of course, with enough of this consumer behavior data, the beginning stages could say, by virtue of the combination of products that you buy or the time of which you buy them or whatever the variable factor is that's a determinant, it's more than correlation. And that then spun out into a series of other endeavors. So what I'll show you here, I'll let you listen to the short version of this. This is old, so it's 2012, 2013. It's IBM Watson, of which I'm sure the fraternity has now gotten hold of already. But this was one of the first experiments where they tried to pass the Turing test. The Turing test is where you talk or engage a machine and you cannot tell that you're engaging a machine. So does this pass the Turing test? Now, I'll let you listen to how Watson speaks here. The competitors in this Jeopardy game, by the way, I think mostly South Africans in the room, Jeopardy is the South African version of, or the American version of Noot for Noot, but it works the other way around. I give you the answer and you've got to give me the question. And so here is Brad and Ken, longest winning streak in the history of the game, current world champion, America only. And then Watson in the middle, and it is now competing. And you tell me how you think this sounds from a Turing test perspective. I'll rewind the plane, Bicky. Just listen to this. In city clunk. Oopsie daisy. Sorry. They say AI is easy, AV is impossible. Okay, in Titan with rewind. There we go. And sir.
Walls have been repaired 17 times. Watson.
What is Jericho?
Correct.
400, same category.
This mystery author and her archaeologist hubby dug in hopes of finding the lost Syrian city of Urkesh.
Watson? Who is Agatha Christie?
Correct.
Same category, 600.
At the Olduvai Gorge in 1959, she and hubby Lewis found a 1.75 million year old Australopithecus Boisei skull.
Watson? Who is Mary Leakey?
You're right.
800, same category.
Okay, watch this in your own time. I'm a little bit short for time. We just notice how the human is starting to change his bodily behavior. It's manifesting his nervousness. That antibody is starting to creep into him because he's having his ass handed to him by a machine that is unplugged from the internet. So an untethered machine. Tell me, pass the Turing test, yes, no? I don't think so, to be honest. I see some say yes, but I thought that sounded still a little bit staccato, still blikkerig, né? So it wasn't really conversational by any stretch. Anyway, that's NLP as a subset of AI, natural language processing, and that then took a whole industry by storm, one of which was the call center space, whereby it tried to emulate these sales conversations, typically for non-financial products, but then later, as regulation allowed, financial products as well. But then another interesting thing started to happen is we started to dig around the data. We could find, specifically in the debt collection space, that listening to voice enabled lie detection. So when someone uses certain phraseology or when they have a certain intonation, you could mirror that with not paying the debt that they were supposed to pay. So now at credit scoring space, you can almost bring that forward and say, well, what is the probability and can I price for that? A company by the name of Beyond Verbal out of Tel Aviv then started a process where they made an app called Moody's, which you can download. And I ran this at an investment conference. And here's the thing. It listens to you for 20 seconds, and it gives you a state of mind with upwards of an 80% accuracy that they've determined through polls. There were three asset managers on the stage, and they were on the hook. This was pre-COVID for performance fees that weren't related to performance. And so the investor community was gutful for it, and they asked them. And this person sat in that room and said, I think it's wrong that the industry charges in this way. I don't know if I'm evoking antibody feelings with anyone right now, but we should be charging based on our performance, not irrespective of our performance. And the other two people literally sat there, shook their heads, and had body language that was negative and turned away. And this person felt lonely in that environment. And I thought that was interesting. Here's another interesting one. This one felt guilt. And by chance or not, they were the lowest performing asset manager with the highest fees. And that guy sits on stage. And so I always joke and I say, if you really want to feel the impact of exponential technology in your private life, download the app, go home tonight and say, turn it on, ask your wife, ask your husband, honey, do you love me? And then you see what the reality is, like how they are feeling. Beyond Verbal then went into a different direction because they also found in scratching through data that some of their specimens were sick, they had cancer. And so what they found was that you could actually identify early stage cancer onset, not all of them, but some of them, by virtue of how people sound and if you have voice data from them. All right. Now, just quickly, I wanted to show you Google DeepMind, which I'm sure has also made its way into the industry on a practical basis. Here, I'll just talk over it, is a game of breakout. So the bat needs to move left to right to touch the ball. If the ball touches it, it bounces back up and you score a point. And the difference between AI and machine learning in colloquial terms is that you ask the machine to figure out the solution. You don't give it to the machine to execute. So it's got to figure it out for itself. So they gave it the code, the rules of the game. They said, play the game. And initially, the thing stood there and it didn't know to move. And then it found out that if I move a touch, it go back. I get a point. That's what they asked me to do. So I do more of it. Then they leave it for an hour and it plays better. And then they leave it for another hour and then it plays even better. And then after 3 hours or so, it plays like the best human. And then 5 hours, it plays like a human can't even imagine. They go away for the weekend, leave the machine on. They come back. This thing's figured out. Dig a tunnel around the side, send the ball around the back. It'll rebound against the top of the thing and clear out that little rainbow, and you get a high score immediately. Right. So that is not quite scary. If you just think of a business case as opposed to an interesting use case, we said to SARS. So imagine at some point the tax practitioner codifies the Tax Act, the code that sits behind the game, and the objective is minimize the tax payment. Go through all the permutations that you can imagine, unimaginable quantums of that, and get to a tax submission that is favorable for the taxpayer. And I'm taking a few shortcuts here, but you understand the concept. What do you think their first reaction was? We will ban it. Where will you ban it? We will ban it in South Africa. Okay, what if the server sits in Mauritius? Or, get this one for size, I have a mate that SpaceX just bought his company because he makes shoebox-sized satellites. And the idea is to, like the Starlink thing, is like the genesis, that was the genesis of it. So lots of constellations of shoebox-sized satellites around the planet to enable high-speed communication. Jason. And he said to me, well, why don't you put that software on my satellite? Because then it's not on the planet. So who's the boss there? No, what regulation? The South African, the Intergalactic Reserve Bank, like who? That doesn't exist. So how will you govern for that? And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but you can get the sort of disruption ability that sits behind this kind of capability if you have, like a kid, a little bit of naivety and creativity in your application of some of these capabilities. And then just in closing, I'm going to wait until I get kicked off here. This is the Alphabet CEO, and he is showing, this is 2019, a thing called Mina. Mina is this voice capability, this data analysis capability, this capability of machine learning to figure out what it is that you, how you get to the end goal. And this is much like Alexa or Siri, but at a whole different scale. So he's doing a live demo. And as he's talking, please listen for the Turing test and where we've come from that first IBM 2012-13 video that I showed you to now 3 years ago. All right, and then I'll show you where we are.
Makes the calls seamlessly in the background for you. So what you're going to hear is the Google Assistant actually calling a real salon to schedule an appointment for you.
Okay, so you're talking to your wife, say, I need a haircut. This thing listens to it and makes the call for you in the background. You don't even know this is happening.
Hi, I'm calling for the haircut for our client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
I can't.
At 12 p.m. We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15. Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.? Depending on what service she would like, what service is she looking for? Just a woman's haircut for now. Okay, we have a 10 o'clock. 10 a.m. is fine. Okay, what's your first name? The first name is Lisa. Okay,
perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks, great. Have a great day. Bye.
That passed the Turing test. I think it passes it with flying colors. Even that little quip that it had, like, mm-hmm, and then it sounds like a human, right? So that's called Mina. And to measure how these bots are performing, so you must start to think credit scoring, sales, onboarding, KYC, like various applications of this, right? But you will only do it if you can trust that the other side is actually listening and is truthful. So there's this huge ethical thing of whether you have to tell a consumer that they are talking with a non-human, all right? But that is very linear thinking because why will I do my KYC if this capability exists? Should I not just give my robot to talk to your robot? And then they don't have to tell each other that they're talking to one another with any ethical consideration, right? So linear thinking versus exponential thinking. And the way in which you measure how these bots are performing is called SSA. It's a specificity and substance quotient. And so I wanted to show you... There are some Chinese versions in the market. This slide is about 3 months old, so that's moved up slightly. That's now at about 83%. Can I just ask you, what do you think is the average human conversation Okay, so SSA, I like Robbie Williams. Oh, that's interesting. Lowe's SSA. I like Robbie Williams. Oh, I also like Rock. Did you see him at Wembley? Yes, I love his leather jacket. Lots of substance, lots of specificity, right? What do you think the average human... globally, the average human SSA score looks like. So how close are we? How close are we really? 86. So we are brimming, man. We are right around the corner from having this sort of capability integrate into our daily lives. Initially, stupid little things. But more and more, as this exponential curve keeps on evolving, less CD, more MP3. It's happened in every industry from the time of horses and cars. Watch out for bias. When you do use this in your organization, here was a recruitment company that tried it. Suddenly, a whole bunch of white males show up for the job interviews because we thought we could automate the screening process. Who coded the automation? White males. And so what do they get? White males. So you've got to be careful about scaling your biases in space like this, specifically because AI doesn't have that differentiation judgmental capability as yet. And then in closing, because I can't touch digital biology and I'm already over time, I thought you would enjoy this. This was an experiment conducted by a very prominent university in Massachusetts. And it had these personas, and it said to a machine that was allowed to drive a car, you are going to be in a situation where you come to a choice for left or right. You're going too fast. You can't stop. You will have to go left or right. So mathematically, you can't eject. And on the left-hand side is one of these personas, and on the right-hand side is the other persona. You got to kill someone. So this is obviously a big thing in insurance when automated cars or automated driving becomes a real thing or a scale thing. And so the question is, who do you let live? Who do you let die? How do you decide that? So society has got to decide that, because a lot of our laws are based on what society wants and don't want, right? So there's a whole other conundrum of how you ethically develop legislation in different jurisdictions, perhaps where the ethics are different, but separate conversation. And so here, it was allowed to scan our news feeds and our social media. And on the back of the sentiment that it derives out of looking at our social media and our news feed, it ranked these things as to who gets to live and who gets to die. So just quickly think there, who would you let live and who would you let die? Kind of playing God for a little bit in a second. Here are the results. Blue is propensity to keep alive. Red is propensity to kill. All right. Now this is very interesting, because look at some of the biases and the judgments that are unfounded that we as society build into crap like this. Okay, person with a pram. So you're assuming that there's a baby in that pram. You're also assuming perhaps that or didn't even think about the fact that that baby might grow up to be a murderer or a criminal. In the looting space, someone said to me, yeah, that could be a TV in that pram, right? So yes, that is true. And then you can see some more recent sentiment in the market. I'm observing, I'm not judging, I'm not giving my own opinion, but you keep a girl alive before you keep a boy alive. We kind of hold hands with what we're seeing in the market. Pregnant women, again, not thinking about mortality rates at birth, about that baby's health, about the mother's health subsequently. But if I need an operation, thanks, I'll take a male doctor. All right? And then maybe a female doctor. Interestingly for all of us, you keep a female athlete alive long before you keep a male executive alive. And then as a dog lover, I was very pleased to see that it gets a shot before a criminal gets a shot. And I will just end off by saying, I don't know how the cat came last. I don't know. Maybe it's because we believe that cats have 9 lives. I honestly don't know. I'm out of time. I'd love to tease a little bit to the art of the future a little bit more. And then maybe next time we'll talk a little bit about digital biology and when longevity ensues. And what the hell do you do if we do live to 160 years old? Because saying things like, I do until death do us part, suddenly has a lot more weight behind it. And do we then also look some relooking of social structures? Maybe you want to upgrade your contract after 40 years or 20 years or something like that. But for now, I'm going to leave you. I hope you have a lackluster of a conference and maybe a little bit of food for thought just on how deep some of these technologies go. And maybe that some of the applications aren't as oorlopend, as obvious, as one might think from the consultants. Have a lekker one. Thanks.